Today on The Grave Talks, a conversation about hauntings, ghosts, Ouija boards, and more with author Jason Offutt. Looking into the haunted history of Missouri, you'll find a lot of very interesting stories. There's the ghosts of Jesse James and his brother Frank, who, by the way, seems to haunt more than one location. There's the very haunted Lemp Mansion in St. Louis, a haunted Civil War battlefield by Springfield. I'm Carol Hughes, and on this episode of The Grave Talks, we'll talk about those hauntings and more with author and paranormal journalist Jason Offutt. So, Jason, I would love to talk to you about how your interest in the paranormal started, because you've written paranormal nonfiction books, and you've done some research around where you live in Missouri, and it makes me think you have something that's happened to you that made all of this kind of a passion and something you wanted to research and write about.
Well, I think everyone who is interested in the paranormal has had some experience. And if they haven't, they've had, grew up listening to experiences that grandma or grandpa had, and they tell those stories. And with me, I grew up on a farm, and I lived in a 120-year-old farmhouse. My family was as there are no such things as ghosts as you could possibly get. My mom, entertained my passion for weird stuff, but she'd never seen anything. So she didn't think ghosts were real. But I had a couple of occurrences in that house that told me, yes, these things are real. And one was innocent enough. I was probably 9 years old, and I walked out of my bedroom into the hallway to where we had all our bookshelves. We had bookshelves lining the walls. And there was a little boy standing in the hallway. And we lived 6 miles away from town. There were no other little boys other than me out in the country. And I'd never seen him before. And he had brown hair parted on the side. He was wearing a blue flannel shirt and blue jeans. And I could see the bookshelf through him. And I stood there. I have no idea how long I stood there. It could have been 12 hours or 3 seconds. It was probably more like 10 seconds. I have no idea how much time went by, but he blinked, and that broke the shock that I was in. And I turned around and walked back into my bedroom and shut the door. And I didn't talk to anybody about it for 30 years, but I saw a full bodied apparition in my house as a kid. And that told me that there was more out there than what my family was admitting to.
Do you think that your other family members might have kind of been like you, and that they had an experience but also didn't want to talk about it and didn't talk about it for years?
This is after my father passed away, so I never got that. Never asked him. He was a big staunch unbeliever. I sat down with my mother and my two older sisters, and that's when I told them about what I'd seen. And they said that they'd never had any experience whatsoever in the house. I am 100% convinced what I had. As a matter of fact, I've always been negative on psychics. I've always thought it was complete hooey, completely discounting that, until I interviewed a psychic, a woman named Joyce Morgan, who's passed away since I talked to her. But she was a pretty famous psychic for a while, and I called her because I wanted to interview her about a paranormal story I was writing. And she didn't know me. This was for my first book, Haunted Missouri. She had no idea who I was. But I called her, and she said, "You've got a ghost in your house, don't you?" I'm like, this was my wife and I were living in an older house in town at this point. And my wife had seen a Tinkerbell-like light above our baby's bed. And I'd never seen it, I thought, because my wife, after she just had the baby and she had to get up and pee a lot, I figured she was just sleepy, until one night I got up and I saw the light above the baby's bed, and it just kind of faded away. Well, I told Joyce about this during our phone call, and I didn't mention what sex the baby was. I didn't tell her anything else, but she goes, "Oh, don't worry about that light. That's just your grandpa, Sam, who's coming to visit to look after his namesake, to make sure little Sam's okay." she nailed the whole everything. Absolutely everything about the baby being Sam, my grandpa being Sam. Yeah. So at that point, I decided, you know what? They're psychics are they're real.
So at that point, sometime in there, you decided it was before this experience with her that you had decided to write the book, The Haunted Missouri.
Right. I was already started working on Haunted Missouri, and I needed to talk to somebody about the James home, Jesse James home in Kearney.
I want to talk about that.
And she had been there with a ghost hunting group. I wanted to interview her about it. And she just asked about the ghost in my house. And I told her, and then what she told me was a lot more impactful than what I told her.
But yeah. It's beautiful. It's just this whole beautiful idea that he could be looking out over the baby.
Right.
I love that.
It was comforting.
Now, since you just brought up the Jesse James farmhouse in Missouri, it's in Kearney, and I read that that's a very haunted house. And did she confirm that? Did you, through your research, find out that's a very haunted house?
Right. She did confirm that. And the people that I interviewed, the docents, they confirmed it as well. The James family, except for Jesse, because he wasn't born yet, moved from, I believe it was Kentucky, to Kearney, Missouri. And Jesse was born in that house. Frank, his older brother, was not. He was born before they got there. They have both been said to haunt the home, Frank especially. I've interviewed a couple of docents who have had people who've seen Frank. One docent was talking to a woman who was scared because she saw a woman walking toward the house, and the woman was dressed in period clothing, and then the woman just vanished. And she described what the woman that she saw looked like, and it was Zerelda, Jesse's wife. By the way, Jesse's mom was also named Zerelda. They're not the same person. But
wait, his mom's name was Zerelda, and he just happened to marry a woman named Zerelda?
Right, that's pretty bizarre.
And I've never heard of that name? Wow.
I never could track this down, but one of the docents, as a matter of fact, she was one of my mom's friends when I was growing up. She told me that a woman visiting took a picture and showed it to her, and there was a face that looked just like Frank's inside the window of the house as the people outside were getting their picture taken. I mean, there were other things like a rocking chair rocking when nobody was standing by it. The old time phone with the receiver you put up to your ear, you pick that up. And that was thrown across the room, and it was only stopped by the cord. So there are a lot of things that happened there. People have reported smelling cooking in the kitchen, and there's no, fire allowed in the house whatsoever.
Do they feel like it's an evil spirit? Because really, let's face it, Frank James wasn't known as a nice guy. He has a pretty interesting, colorful past.
Well, yeah, the James boys were villains.
They were good idolized guys.
Right. Yeah, they were idolized by millions of people across the world, and they were villains. But no, I haven't really heard of anything like that. Although the phone being tossed across the room, that happened when somebody visiting said something bad about the James family. Don't talk bad about me.
And I also read, and there's reports of Frank James haunting other places. I mean, if you're a ghost, anything's possible, right? But you always associate somebody haunting, that's this person. But can he haunt more than one place? I don't know why you couldn't. But I was reading of some other places that are supposedly haunted by him.
That is something that is a misconception that has been shown in the media for decades upon decades upon decades. As a matter of fact, I remember a Abbott and Costello movie where they were Revolutionary War ghosts and couldn't leave this house. But I mean, that's generally the consensus. I mean, you see a ghost at a cemetery, and that ghost is always in the cemetery. But what happens, though, is the ghost can go anywhere it wants. I mean, why would you want to hang out at the cemetery, right?
It makes sense that you could just go here or there. Or even, I don't know, you could be in two places at one time. I don't know.
Right. Well, yeah, we don't know the rules there.
There is no rule book available for us.
But people have reported this forever that a ghost followed them home. So I love telling people that ghosts can follow you home. If they take a liking to you, or they're interested in you, or they're angry with you, they might just follow you home. So they can definitely travel. Frank's ghost has been seen at the Missouri Governor's Mansion in Jefferson City. And in the 1859 Marshall's home, jail, and museum in Independence, Missouri, Frank was a prisoner. Actually, he was not a prisoner. He was a guest at that prison, because at that, when he was there, or when he was arrested and was there, he was famous at that point. I mean, it was like Mayberry, you know, watching the Andy Griffith Show. His door was unlocked. People would give him presents. People would come by to play, you know, checkers with him and give him books and give him candy. And he had a nice bed. And he would have dinner with the Marshall's family. I've interviewed a number of people who've worked at that place, and they will smell cooking, you know, like baking bread back in the kitchen. In Frank's room, the bed will always, every morning when somebody shows up, a docent shows up, the bed will look like it slept in. At one point, somebody decided to put a Christmas tree in Frank's cell. And the next morning when they came back, the Christmas tree had been thrown out in the hallway.
So no Christmas trees for Frank James.
No Christmas trees. No. In fact, I love this story. And this is an older story from Atchison, Kansas, from the Sally House. I interviewed a woman who worked at, she worked with a ghost hunting group, and they were allowed to go to the Sally House, I don't know, 20 years ago, maybe. She said something followed her home. She felt like there was something in the car with her when she drove home to Topeka. And for a couple of weeks afterward, when her phone would ring sometimes, not all the time, but sometimes she'd pick it up and somebody would be breathing into the phone, and nobody, they wouldn't answer. They just breathe. But when she'd walk back into the bedroom, her phone in the bedroom would be off the hook. And eventually it went away, but it was pretty creepy in her house for a while.
Here's the thing. I don't want like a Frank James or somebody like that ever following me home. They're taking care of you in this jail.
I'll go visit Farrah Fawcett's childhood home.
Right.
She was my crush as a kid. So that's what I want. I want her to follow me.
So another place in Missouri that you wrote about in Haunted Missouri, the Limp Mansion. So
I sure did.
Now, after reading about this, because you brought it to my attention, I wasn't familiar with the Limp Mansion. That whole family has a very dark, interesting, scandalous history and very sad history, but they were extremely wealthy, built this mansion. It's in St. Louis, right?
Right.
I'm going to let you tell their story. I think it's very interesting.
Okay. And it's Limp for the listeners, L-E-M-P. They were a German family that immigrated to the United States in the 1800s, settled in St. Louis, and they started a brewery. And for a while, the Limp Brewing Company was a rival to the Anheuser-Busch Brewing Company. And in the early part of the 1900s, early part of the 20th century, when Prohibition came, the Anheuser-Busch Company figured out how to deal with Prohibition. They made furniture. I think they sold milk, maybe. But they produced other products that kept them going. The Limp family didn't do that. And so they were starting to lose money after they built this beautiful mansion. The father committed suicide. That wasn't the only one. One of his sons committed suicide. I believe a daughter-in-law died in the house. One of the last suicides was William Limp Jr., I believe. And I like talking about him because it was pretty interesting what happened when I visited the Limp Mansion, and then it involves him. He was known to wear a top hat. I'm just throwing that out for something I'm going to bring back in a minute. He was known for wearing a top hat, and he was also known for having a Doberman Pinscher. He loved his dog. Well, he was going through depression, and he wanted to end it all, but he knew nobody else in the family liked his dog. So he killed his dog before he killed himself. Mm. Now, over the decades and decades since this occurred, It's been a boarding house. It's a bed and breakfast now and has been for 20, 30 years, something like that. But people have stayed there and they have reported seeing a black shadow with a top hat and a cape. And people think that that is, you know, William Limp Jr. But what they've also heard is a dog barking inside the house, inside the building, the nails of a dog ticking on the hardwood floors.
That's a very distinct sound, too.
Oh, absolutely. Yes. Even now in carpeted rooms, people staying at the bed and breakfast will report hearing the dog barking and those nails clicking on the hardwood, even though the hardwood's covered. Now, I'm saying that because, interesting, but one of my best friends from high school lives in St. Louis, and I called him, told him I was going to the Limp Mansion, and he's like, I want my wife and me to go. So they did. And they stayed downstairs, and they got some iced tea, and it was summer. It was in the mid-90s. It was so hot that day. They were wearing shorts, and they stayed downstairs while before I interviewed anybody, I just wandered the house. I finally made it to the third floor, which was the servants' quarters back in the day. And it was the one floor that has not been remodeled yet. It might be now, but it wasn't back in 2006 when I went there. So it was in pretty rough condition. There was no air conditioning. I was sweating buckets because it was so hot. Down this hallway, I stopped because I walked into a spot that was so cold. I stopped sweating immediately and I got goose pimples up and down my arms. And there were no vents that air conditioning had coming from from below. And I stepped back and it was super hot again. And I stepped forward and it was frigid. Then I stepped forward again and it was hot. And I stepped backward and it was frigid. And the next time I stepped out, it disappeared. I guess I upset the ghost. I found a cold spot, which was pretty cool because I hadn't experienced that before. Well, when I finally got downstairs and I talked to my friends, they were standing there drinking tea. And my friend's wife felt a dog rub up against her legs. And when she looked down, of course, there was nothing there. But that's a distinct feeling as well.
It is, because, you know, you just expect to look down and see a dog and you're going to pet it.
And there was no dog. There was nothing to pet.
And the cold spot, too, when it's really hot like that and you're up there high and there's no ventilation, like, I know that feeling. Like, it's really hot. You can't breathe. Mm-hmm. And what's going to cause a really cold spot like that? And it's weird, too. You stepped out and stepped back into it.
Mm-hmm. Made a joke when my wife went with me to the Anderson House. It's a Civil War. There was a battlefield there. It's in Lexington, Missouri. It was like 24 degrees and there was no heating in the house. And I made the joke that, you know, we could be in a cold spot right now. We wouldn't know it. It was so cold. But anybody out there who is interested, I'm not being a salesman. I'm not getting paid for this, but the Limp Mansion's a bed and breakfast. People do experience the paranormal there. And they have ghost tours and, you know, people have weddings there and all sorts of fun stuff.
And when you think about the family, and especially there's mental illness in this family, there were suicides, multiple suicides in the family. I even read about, I don't know if it's true though, about one of the children had an illegitimate son. And in the story, they called him Monkey Face Boy. And supposedly he was in the attic or something.
But yes, that was the case. Also, there were caves underneath the building. And there have been, you know, ghost stories that go along with caves like that. So it's everything about the Limp Mansion, from its what it's built on, the structure of the building, the misery that happened within it. It's just rife with you know, for ghost encounters.
I do want to also in that book talk about the Wilson's Creek Civil War battlefield.
Right.
Wait, is that by Springfield?
It's right by Springfield. Yes. A little bit south, if I remember correctly. So right now you're a lot closer to it than I am.
I did go to a battlefield around that area. I went to Branson and through Springfield on the way home. I'm guessing it had to have been that Civil War battlefield.
I think that's the one down there. Yeah, I think that's the only one down there.
I think any place you go where there's any battlefield, Civil War, Revolutionary War, wherever it is, a lot of trauma happened there. All these people died with unfinished business. And there were thousands of people who died or were very horrifically injured in that battle.
One hill called Bloody Hill for a reason. There were 1,700 casualties on that one hill during the battle. The Union forces lost 24% of the army that they had down there. The Confederates lost 12%. And that's not even counting all the horses they lost as well. So there was a lot of blood during that. The battle happened in, I think it was the second week of July in 1861. The Union had lost ground to the Confederacy, and they went down there to stomp the Confederate Army, and the Union Army ended up losing. A really good friend of mine and a Civil War buff was down there. He and his wife. And it was about time for the park to close. And he said he swore that he heard cannons going off. And I've you know, read that that's kind of a common occurrence. I also interviewed a person who worked there who didn't want to talk to me, but I'm like, come on, I've heard this and this. And she said, okay, I'll tell you this story. And the postmaster's house, which is still there, you can visit it. People have reported seeing people in period clothing. One specific tour group was going through there, and they saw a girl I think she was 12 or 13, they said, with blonde hair, period clothing, walked from the house with a bucket down to the creek, Wilson's Creek, to fill the bucket up, and then walked back to the house. And they complimented, you know, back at the center, when they were ready to leave, they complimented the reenactors, and they're like, there's no reenactors here today.
Oh.
And they described the girl they saw, and that fit the postmaster's daughter at the time of the battle.
Because you would assume that when you're at a historic place like that, so many of them do have reenactors, and yeah, you just kind of assume.
Absolutely. That's what I'd do. I'd assume that.
And I've heard apparitions of soldiers as well.
Right. I think that there was a story. I don't know this for, this is coming secondhand. It's something I read about Wilson's Creek. Some people not at the battlefield, but nearby, were hunting on their own land and saw Union soldiers and heard Union soldiers walking through the forest. Or the trees, not really, not the forest.
It's pretty wooded. It's pretty wooded area in some of the places. It's a big area.
Sure, yeah.
Now, you wrote a couple other books too that are about Missouri. It's so interesting to me. I've been to Missouri so many times, and I never really realized just how many hauntings there are. But one of them, Paranormal Missouri, Show Me Your Monsters. When I was reading about the book, it talks about things like ghosts and Bigfoot, and I've heard there's a monster there, Momo, the Missouri monster. But one thing that really jumped out at me was terrifying Ouija board encounters. I have this fascination, and I don't know, it's a fascination and repulsion the same kind of time when it comes to Ouija boards. I really don't want anything to do with them, but then I'm fascinated by stories about Ouija boards. And I wondered if you remembered off the top of your head that story.
I do. I don't remember the names involved, but I do remember the story. I'm going to take just a step back from the different books. What, Haunted Missouri, I'm going to step back to that one, because okay, I've always liked reading books about haunted places. Mm-hmm. And they're always, it seems to me, about places that are, you know, private residences. And when I was putting Haunted Missouri together, what I wanted to do is write a guidebook for haunted places that are open to the public. So every place in that book you can go to, anybody can go to. It may cost money, you know, admission fee, right, but you can go to that. In Paranormal Missouri and my other What Lurks Beyond, those are, you know, the especially Paranormal Missouri are just, they're personal stories from people. So it's not like that. It's anything that I bring up in those books, or that book, is off limits to people. So don't knock on anybody's doors. Okay. But anyway, yeah, you ask about the Ouija board, and I agree completely. And this also goes for automatic writing or seances. What you are doing in all those cases, as a matter of fact, just speaking into the air, how you do it, is an invitation to things you can't see. You don't know who's going to answer your invitation. And it might say things to you that make you think, oh my gosh, that's my great Aunt Edna. It's most probably not your great Aunt Edna. It's somebody pretending something.
They're mimicking great Aunt Edna.
Exactly. And they might know stuff only great Aunt Edna would know. But you know, whatever you're talking to might have been around for hundreds of thousands of years and has been watching you and watching Edna. So, yeah, Ouija boards, please stay away is my advice. But anyway, this happened at a Catholic university, if I remember correctly. And these girls were having, they wanted to play with the Ouija board. So they got the Ouija board out and they put candles around the board. And one of the girls was really nervous, so she didn't want to play. But the other ones did. They put their hands on the planchette and started asking questions. And the planchette started moving. And it started answering some questions. And then they made the mistake of saying, "Who is this?" And whoever was behind it spelled out Satan. And then the candles went out. And somebody saw something at the window. And they turned and looked and screamed because there was the head and shoulders looked of a man in shadow in the window. But they were on the second floor of the dormitory. They all screamed and ran the heck out of the room and stayed in one of the other girls' rooms. And the next day, they got one of the priests. They told the priest what they did, and he scolded them and went and blessed the room. And the two girls who lived in the room went and moved into a different one. But that is scary. I do want to say, though, whatever the being would be that was mimicking great Aunt Edna was mimicking Satan, too. A higher level entity is not going to mess with Ouija boards, but the lower ones definitely will. And they will often lie to those who are silly enough to talk to them. I teach a class like every 4 or 5 years at the university where I teach. It's called paranormal journalism. And it's a reporting class, but the kids love it because we report on paranormal occurrences. And I took myself and our department engineer took this class on a field trip to the Villisca axe murder house.
Oh, I've heard of that one.
Yeah, it's pretty famous. It's only about a 50-minute drive. It's less than an hour drive from here. And I told them, don't bring a Ouija board. So they brought a Ouija board.
Oh.
They used it only once. Because as they were asking questions, one of the guys said, "What's my name?" And it spelled out Aaron. And Aaron's like, "Okay, we're done. Goodbye. Let's say goodbye. We're not doing this anymore."
You teach a class in paranormal journalism, did you say?
Yes.
When you talk about paranormal journalism, what exactly is the approach to journalism and reporting on the paranormal?
Okay, so I teach journalism in the Communication and Mass Media School at Northwest Missouri State University. I was a print journalist for 17 years before I started teaching, but I've been interested in the paranormal all my life. One of the things that has always bothered me in recent decades, not back, you know, in the 70s, they covered UFO encounters and Bigfoot. You know, they covered it straight, but since like the 80s, they stopped doing that. And anytime there's, you know, a mass UFO sighting, the X-Files is mentioned. Anytime there's a ghost sighting, they mention Ghostbusters. You know, with Bigfoot, they mention Harry and the Hendersons. No matter how else the story goes, that lead already makes a joke out of the story.
Right.
So I was using the paranormal bent to teach them that you have to write seriously about any topic you report, seriously and unbiasedly. And I thought using the paranormal one would attract a lot of students, and it does. And two, it would be good practice to do some honest, solid, unbiased reporting on, you know, a fun topic like, oh my gosh, these people saw a UFO.
And it's also something that you're reporting on that you can't 100% prove. So how do you report on it?
It's a lot of eyewitness testimony. Mm-hmm. If you are interviewing somebody on something that they had seen, that other people had seen, you know, like, for example, I did a story for one of my books about Big Lake Park. It's a park in Council Bluffs, Iowa, where a ton of people across Council Bluffs saw a UFO, and the UFO dropped something in the park that was recovered. And Jacques Vallée, the famous UFO researcher, went to Council Bluffs back in the late 60s to take on this story. But I interviewed people who were there when it happened. So I was able to go through Vallée's writing. I was able to interview various eyewitnesses and go to the spot where it actually happened and take a look at it. So that's kind of the type of thing I was teaching my students. If it's historical, there's already research done that you need to dig into, but look for the witnesses.
After you talk to those witnesses, do you feel like they really did see a UFO?
I'm going to say yes. I'm going to say they saw UFO in its literal sense. It was unidentified and it was an object that was flying. However, where did it come from? I can't say. However, right. It was a ball. It was glowing white. It had a red ring around it, ring of lights around it. And it dropped a smelter slag. It dropped a big goob glop of molten smelter slag that when the fire department showed up was still glowing blue in the middle.
Oh.
And there were people from different sides of this park who saw it and reported it. So I believe that they did see something. And yeah, there was physical evidence. They saw a fall, all saw a fall from the craft.
And that wraps up part one of our conversation with author Jason Offutt. In our next episode, we'll be talking about shadow people and the book he wrote about shadow people. Get more information about him and his books at his website, jasonoffutt.com. That's spelled OFFUTT. If you'd like access to all of our episodes, including the archive and advanced episodes, everything commercial free, become a Gravekeeper. Sign up on Apple Podcasts and you can try it 3 days absolutely free. Or go to patreon.com/thegravetalks and find everything there. Also, all ad free. For all of us at The Grave Talks, I'm Carol Hughes. Thanks for listening.